stream out of the dugout. Yeah. Rollins ball near third. This game is over.
Second deck walk-off home run. Grand slam, Bryce Harper.
That's what I call hitting season.
Now batting for the Phillies, John Stolness.
Hey there, podcast pals, and welcome back to another edition of Hittin' Season. This is episode number 468. I'm John Stolness from The Good Fight. You can follow me on Twitter at John Stolness. And coming up, we're going to recap the Phillies series against the San Francisco Giants, where Gabe Kapler made his what turned out to be triumphant return to Philadelphia. We'll tell you how the three-game series went in case you missed some of it. Bryce Harper is cooking right now. We'll tell you about how hot he's been. Why April is always a crazy month on the baseball calendar, and I'm going to answer some mailbag questions from our Patreon members, exclusively from our Patreon members. And again, you can become a Patreon member to Hittin' Season by going to patreon.com/hittin'season, and whenever we do one of these mailbag episodes, your questions will be the only ones answered on that particular podcast. Plus, I will have your stat of the week. So no guests this week. It's just going to be you and me talking some Phillies baseball because we do have a lot to get to here on the podcast. And we'll start off talking about Gabe Kapler's grand return to Philadelphia. The Phillies almost handed him a series sweep, but did manage to take the final game of the three-game series with a dramatic walk-off win on Wednesday. The Phillies won the finale 6-5 on a bottom-of-the-ninth walk-off RBI single from Andrew Knapp, of all people, which scored Bryce Harper from second base. He walked to lead off the bottom of the ninth inning. Harper was definitely the hero of this game. He hit a game-tying home run in the bottom of the seventh to tie things up at 5-5 after the Phillies had blown a 4-1 lead in the top of the inning. Now, before we get too deep into Bryce Harper's last few days, last week, last couple, actually, frankly, his whole season so far, we do have to start off talking about the return of Gabe Kapler. But really, after the initial booing, which was expected and frankly wasn't as lustily booed as I expected him to be, Gabe Kapler was hardly a storyline. Because the Giants' wins were not really the result of Gabe Kapler. Kapler didn't do anything terribly unorthodox in this three-game series. Didn't do anything out of the ordinary, at least not as far as I could see. Looked like a pretty typical baseball team being run a pretty typical way, and there was nothing that made you stand and look at Gabe Kapler and say, what is he doing? And frankly, that's what your manager is supposed to do. You're not really supposed to notice him all that much. And so Gabe Kapler was hardly a storyline. It would have been more of a storyline had the Giants ended up holding on and sweeping the Phillies in this three-game series. That would have been quite a storyline for sure. But still, winning 2 out of 3 means a little bit of vindication maybe for Gabe Kapler. A little bit of a, you know, he's certainly got to be not happy about the team losing on Wednesday, but feeling pretty good about coming into Philadelphia and winning the series. Now, the Phillies, of course, head to Denver feeling good about themselves after not, you know, they blew the lead on Wednesday, but pulling it out with the dramatics in the bottom of the ninth inning. And really the story of this weekend, of this week, was really more the bullpen and the Phillies' flailing offense. Let's talk about the bullpen first. The 2020 version of this relief corps tried to rear their ugly heads on Tuesday and Wednesday. On Tuesday, in the middle game of the series, it was Connor Brogdon who gave up 2 separate 3-run home runs in the 8th inning, which turned a 6-4 lead into a 10-6 deficit in a game the Phillies would lose 10-7. Very strange to have a relief pitcher give up 2 separate 3-run home runs. Usually the relief pitcher is pulled from that game. And if you want to argue about anything Joe Girardi did this week, I think that's probably the biggest thing. Connor Brogdon was on a roll this year. I mean, he hadn't given up an earned run since August of last year. In fact, Brogdon had a scoreless streak of 15 1/3 innings going until he gave up the first of the 2 3-run home runs. So it's hard to get too mad at the guy. He hadn't given up an earned run since August 20th of last year. So Connor Brogdon has had a fantastic season for the Phillies, and it's unfortunate that giving up 6 earned runs is going to balloon his ERA. I think it's over 7 now, whereas it had been 0 heading into the game. So again, not going to kill Connor Brogdon. on what turned out to be a really bad night. He said he was really excited to play against the Giants. It was a team he grew up rooting for, and so that undoubtedly factored into his inability to control his changeup. He said he was just a little bit too fired up and lost the feel for it once he was on the mound. But that was a brutal loss for sure, and it was certainly reminiscent of what we saw last season. And then on Wednesday, it was Brandon Kinsler's turn again, and Kinsler has been very solid for the Phillies relief corps, but he gave up a game-tying home run in the seventh inning, a three-run shot to, of all people, former Philly prospect Darren Ruff. Darren Ruff, folks, still in the majors. He's been with the Giants, actually, for the last couple of years over in San Francisco playing for Gabe Kapler. And it's, you know what, of all the players, I was happy for Darren Ruff. And really, frankly, the fact that the Phillies won this game allows me to be fully happy for Darren Ruff. You got to think about what the journey he's been through, going to South Korea after kind of washing out of Major League Baseball, playing well enough there to get a Major League deal and be back in the big leagues playing for the San Francisco Giants. Pretty cool stuff. And then he comes back to Philadelphia, a place where I was higher on Darren Ruff than virtually everyone else. It turns out he was not as good as I thought he was going to be. And listen, that's going to be one of those guys I'm just going to admit I wasn't right about. But I definitely think Darren Ruff had some potential to be a decent Major League Baseball player, and he has found a spot with the Giants, and it had to feel good for him to come back to Philadelphia, where he was booed by the fans, by the way, for reasons passing understanding. What did Darren Ruff do to earn boos? I mean, come on, guys. And hit that three-run home run to tie the game at four. I kind of felt a little bit vindicated at the moment it happened, and a little bit happy for Darren Ruff if I was, you know, a little bit more upset that the Phillies had blown that lead. But, you know, and then later that inning, Andrew McCutchen drops the fly ball. The Giants go ahead and lead the game 5-4 after that. But Darren Ruff, good for you, buddy. I mean, I'm glad you guys didn't win the game, but it was kind of cool to see him hit that three-run home run, if you're just talking about it from a personal standpoint. Now, one bright spot in the bullpen this weekend was Spencer Howard. He was called up before the game on Sunday for his second go-around in the bullpen this year, and he was absolutely electric. He got out of a two-out, two-on jam by getting Buster Posey to foul out, and then struck out the side in the eighth inning, touching 98 miles an hour on his fastball. He looked unbelievable. Now, there's a lot of people calling for Spencer Howard to take Matt Moore's spot in the rotation, to move into the starting rotation. Guys, it's just not going to happen this year. Dave Dombrowski has said Howard is going to be used as a relief pitcher this season because he just hasn't gotten enough innings under his belt these last couple of years, and they do not want to mess with his shoulder. He's had some injury problems with it this year. They're going to take it very easy on him. They want him to just kind of get his innings in this year as a relief pitcher. And if he can put in the kind of work that he did on Wednesday for the rest of the year, he's going to be an electric option in that bullpen. So Howard will take Vince Velasquez's spot in the bullpen for as long as Vinny Velocity is needed in the rotation. He'll take Matt Moore's place in the rotation, as Matt Moore was placed on the COVID-19 injury list earlier this week. So some ripple effects from some different things going on as far as the injury list is concerned and the COVID list is concerned. But a great sign from Spencer Howard. And the bullpen really did a great job on Monday after Chase Anderson was pulled after four innings. He was pulled for a pinch hitter in the bottom of the fourth, and the bullpen went ahead and pitched five shutout innings and kept that game to a 2-0 score. The Phillies offense just was not able to do much in that game. And so the bullpen had a great night on Monday, not a great night on Tuesday. Really, it was just one guy, Connor Brogdon, who has been fantastic since being called up at the end of last year. Just kind of have to throw that one out and start from scratch, and I think he'll be back to normal. And then Brandon Kinsler got hit around with a three-run home run from Darren Ruff in this game. But some fine pitching by Hector Neris in the ninth inning on Wednesday, too. Don't want to forget about that. A 1-2-3 ninth inning that helped set things up in the bottom of the ninth inning for Bryce Harper's heroics. And that's where we want to move next, because what Bryce Harper is doing is exactly what we were all hoping that he was going to do when the season started. And it's a long year. He got off to a fast start last year, and then the back issues started to creep in, and those back issues are going to be a concern for the entire season. Just is. I don't like it any more than you do. But he's playing really well, and if he can give himself time off, and we talked about this on the episode that I recorded with Justin and Liz on Sunday night, if he can manage his body, if he can take the time off when he needs it, take a day off here and there, realize he's 28 years old and not 23 years old, I think we're going to have to accept the fact that Bryce Harper may not play all 162, but if he can give you 152 at an MVP level, you're going to take that. And he's playing at an MVP level right now. Harper is tied with Justin Turner and Jazz Chisholm with a 1.1 Fangraphs wins above replacement. That's second best in the National League behind Ronald Acuña Jr.'s 1.6. Acuña really burst out of the gate looking like he was going to be a 40-40 guy, and that still might be the case. But Harper's peripherals are fantastic. He's barreling everything. Everything coming off his bat has been hard hit. His walk rate is better than his strikeout rate. Through Wednesday's game, Harper has a 19.7% walk rate, is striking out just 18.3% of the time. This is a continuing trend from last year when his walk rate and his strikeout rate reversed historical trends where his strikeout rate was always much higher. So if he's walking this much and striking out this little, he's going to put up these kinds of numbers. 357 batting average, 493 on base percentage, 625 slugging with 4 home runs and 13 runs scored. That's an amazing slash line, and again, we're just a few weeks into the season, so there's a long way to go here. What's criminal is that Bryce Harper has just 8 runs batted in on the season, and that is not because of anything Bryce Harper has failed to do. That is because no one is getting on base in front of him, and that includes the seven and the eight-hole hitters, right? You have the 9-hole hitter. You have the pitchers hitting this year, which, again, I detest. I detest with the passion of 10,000 suns, but now you have the 8-hole hitter, which has been the center fielder for this season, not getting on base, the 9-hole hitter not getting on base, Andrew McCutchen struggling tremendously at the plate this year, still hitting well under 200 on the season, not getting on base, and then Rhys Hoskins has had an okay season so far when he's hit in front of Bryce Harper, but he's not lighting the world on fire, still hitting around 250, his on-base percentage is under 300. So you've got 4 or 5 guys hitting before Bryce Harper who are just not getting on base in front of him. If the Phillies lineup can ever figure out a way to get people on base in front of Bryce Harper when he's hitting like this, they're not going to be stopped. You're not going to be able to stop this team from scoring. But Bryce Harper just isn't getting the opportunities when he gets to the plate. 8 RBIs on the season so far, just not good enough for the Phillies as a whole. If you want this guy to be the MVP, he's got to get guys on in front of him. So he needs help from his teammates, and maybe, just maybe, what we saw on Wednesday from Mickey Moniak and Nick Maton can be the beginning of something. After notching a single on Tuesday, which was the first time a Philly center fielder had gotten a hit for the Phils since April 4th, Moniak got the Phillies on the board on Wednesday with an opposite field 3-run home run in the second inning, the first long ball of the former number one overall pick's career. He also made a couple of outstanding catches in center field during the series against the Giants, so maybe, Mickey Moniak is losing the deer in headlights look and starting to settle in here in the big leagues. His opposite field home run was very well struck. It was kind of a windy day at Citizens Bank Park, but it occurred before the winds and the storm that came through that delayed things for about an hour started whipping things up. And if Moniak can give the Phillies just a little bit of offense there in the 8-hole and fix this center field problem, it just makes things so much better for the lineup. So that was a great thing to see from Mickey Moniak. Just maybe Moniak starting to settle in a little bit here now that he's gotten a few games under his belt at the big leagues. And you got to think getting that first home run just helps take the monkey off his back a little bit. Maybe that single the other night helped loosen things up a little. He finally broke his over. He had been doing nothing but striking out, been looking overmatched at the plate. And finally, it looked like Moniak was starting to calm down and let the game come to him. Speaking of being calm and letting the game come to him, Nick Maton played really well this week. Took the place of Ronald Torres, who is in the COVID-19 protocol himself. Started all 3 games this week after Didi Gregorius hurt his elbow. He went 3-for-4 with a run scored and is hitting .417 in limited action thus far. He's looked like he should stay on the roster ahead of Torres when Torres is eligible to come off the COVID list. Actually, Maton 5-for-12 on the season, has shown good range at shortstop when he played there. And it looks like Gene Segura is going to be out for a little bit, so a little bit more on that in just a second. But you can either play him at second base or Brad Miller at second base. Brad Miller had a 4-hit game on Wednesday, so a couple of options there for the Phillies at second. maybe some of these guys are starting to pick it up a little bit, and but it's going to take more than one game before we see that for sure. Now, Tuesday night's game was a crusher of a loss. The Phillies had a 4-0 lead heading into the third, a 6-3 lead after the fifth, and Zach Wheeler just couldn't keep the Giants down. Gave up 4 runs in 5 2/3 innings. You'd like your co-ace to do a little bit better than that. And Wheeler admitted as much after the game he said he was the reason the team lost. That's not the case. Connor Brogdon is the reason the team lost that game on Tuesday. But certainly, Zach Wheeler, you'd like to have him shut things down once he's given a 4-0 lead, and that just didn't happen in the second game of the series. And then, of course, in the opener, as I mentioned a few minutes ago, the Phillies were shut out 2-0. The offense, really, a huge problem still so far this year. They got a pretty good effort from Chase Anderson, who was pulled early after just 4 innings for a pinch hitter when the Phillies threatened but did not score in the bottom of the fourth. It was the right move by Girardi. I thought he had to go for it there. The offense has really been struggling this season. It was a big opportunity to kind of dig out of a 2-0 hole. Brad Miller came to the plate with the bases loaded, but like so many moves Girardi has made this year, it just didn't work out. And in that first game of the series, the Phillies were 0-for-8 with runners in scoring position, left 11 men on base and being shut out by Kevin Gausman and a collection of Giants relievers. So it was a tough series for the Phillies. The game on Wednesday looked like it was going to be a loss until Bryce Harper saved the day in the bottom of the eighth inning with a home run that really just seemed like an angry home run. He hit it, and it got out so fast, and he stepped on home plate and just kind of pumped his shoulders, like, come on, let's go. You know, he's trying to implore the rest of his offense to get things going. And luckily for them, in the bottom of the ninth inning, they were able to do it. They had a chance in the bottom of the eighth inning to take the lead, but Rhys Hoskins struck out with the bases loaded against former Philly Jose Alvarez. It was good to see him back in Citizens Bank Park. The last time we saw Jose Alvarez, he was doubled over in some pain after getting a line drive into the lower nether regions last year, of course. All right, so the Phillies' injury situation has really come to the forefront here over the last couple of days. They're already missing Archie Bradley, and he's probably going to be on the shelf for a couple of months. Jose Alvarado is not available. He is in the COVID-19 protocol, so two of the team's best relievers are on the shelf. We don't know for how long. Gene Segura has been placed on the injured list with a strained right quad after running out of ground ball on Tuesday night, so Scott Kingery was called up before the game on Wednesday, and that's a big loss. Segura had been one of the best Phillies hitters so far this year, one of the few guys consistently hitting, had been 15 for his last 37. So the Phillies are going to miss his bat in the lineup, and again, Brad Miller or Nick Maton will probably get most of those starts. Although, with Scott Kingery called up, maybe they go with Kingery, but for right now, Brad Miller and Nick Maton are better options than Scott Kingery, which tells you a lot. Matt Moore is on the COVID injury list. I don't think any of us were anxious to see Matt Moore make his next start, especially in Colorado, but now Vinny Velasquez will start in his place on Friday night. Look, you're kind of seeing why the Phillies kept Velasquez. It's for situations like this, and they really don't have a whole lot of depth outside of Velasquez. They really kind of need him here in these types of situations. And so hopefully Velasquez can keep the Rockies from scoring less than 7 to 10 runs in this game. I mean, Vince Velasquez in Coors Field is wee time, right? It's who knows? He's gone up against German Marquez, who is the Rockies' best starter. So that, if you're playing daily fantasy, if you take the Phillies and they win, you probably end up doing pretty well. But it's not something that I would put a whole lot of money on. And then Didi Gregorius is expected to return to the lineup on Friday night after missing 2 games with a sore elbow. So thankfully, his return to the lineup looks like it's imminent, and that is good news for a Phillies offense that needs all the bats that they can get. All right, we'll step away, and we'll take a quick break. When we come back, I'm going to detail a little bit about the month of April. It's been a crazy month, not just for the Phillies, but for the rest of Major League Baseball as well. I'll break down some of the numbers coming up and answer some of the Patreon members' mailbag questions. Those things are coming up next here on Hittin' Season. And we're back on Hittin' Season. So I wrote a piece for The Good Fight this week as we are watching this Phillies team stumble and strumble and bumble through this month of April. It hasn't gone terribly smoothly so far. The Phillies have played like a 500 team. That's just what they have been. That's what they are. And it hasn't been fun to watch, but the Phillies are still a 500 team at 9-9 here as we get closer and closer to the month of April ending. And I understand why the fan base is upset. I'm not happy with how they started off 5-1 and have retreated. They've gone 4-8 since that 5-1 start. It's a $200 million roster. They should be better, right? They should be able to field a major league caliber center fielder. They should be able to have a viable leadoff hitter. They should not be playing such porous defense. And again, Andrew McCutchen drops an easy fly ball that leads to the go-ahead run on Wednesday. And most importantly, a $200 million payroll should hit more. Heading into the game on Wednesday, the Phillies were still tied for 10th in the National League in OPS. They were 10th in slugging and on-base percentage and had scored just 64 runs in 17 games for an average of 3.76. That number went up a little bit, obviously, after the game on Wednesday. But this is a weird month, right? The April is always when you see some crazy outlier stats. And you'll see a couple of those in the piece that I wrote for The Good Fight. I encourage you to check it out. But look at what else is going on around Major League Baseball. I mean, all you have to do is take a look at the Major League Baseball standings to see how crazy things are right now. So even in just looking in the National League East, the Mets lead the NL East with a 7-6 record, but they have a run differential of negative 14, which is second worst in the entire division. The Phillies are just a half a game behind at 9-9. The Miami Marlins are one game behind the Mets, half a game behind the Phillies at 8-9, while Atlanta is 8-10, a game and a half back, and Washington is 7-9, also a game and a half back. Washington is a game and a half out of first place, yet with a negative 20 run differential. The only team in the National League East with a positive run differential is the Miami Marlins. Everybody else has a negative run differential. The Mets at negative 14, the Phillies at negative 6, Atlanta's just at negative 1, but Washington at negative 20. It's been a very weird start to April. And this happens every April. I mean, of course, everyone expected the New York Yankees to be sitting at 6-11, didn't they? Right? They are tied with the Minnesota Twins, also another team, another preseason favorite, at 6-11. The worst records in the National League, the Yankees and the Twins. If you looked at the preseason rankings, just about everybody had the Yankees winning the AL East, and most people had the Twins winning the AL Central, probably a combination between them and the White Sox. And right now, the Kansas City Royals are in first place in the AL Central at 9-7, while the White Sox are at 9-9. It's just weird. No one predicted Boston to have the best record in the American League at 12-6. To have the best run differential in baseball at plus 30. Probably not in baseball, they're just behind the Dodgers. But the best run differential in the American League at plus 30. Nobody expected that. Nobody expected the San Francisco Giants to be in second place in the National League West with an 11-7 record. Better than San Diego's 10-10 record. But yet, here we are. I mean, sure, everyone expected that Milwaukee's Omar Narvaez would be tied with Bryce Harper, Trey Turner, and Starling Marte for fifth in the National League in wins above replacement heading into Wednesday. Those numbers shifted a little bit after Wednesday's game. But that Tyler Naquin and Ryan McMahon would be tied for second in homers in the National League with five each. And if I asked you to give me the top three RBI men on the Dodgers, Justin Turner's a name you would probably think of. Corey Seager is probably a name you would probably think of. But Zach McKinstry? Would you be thinking that Zach McKinstry was second on the Dodgers in RBIs? Of course you wouldn't. Here's another oddity. Corbin Burnes struck out 10 and walked nobody on Tuesday for the Milwaukee Brewers. He's the first pitcher since the mound was set at its current distance in 1893 to post four straight starts with at least nine strikeouts and no walks at any point in the season. He has 40 strikeouts and no walks to start the season. Did you think that the Bronx Bombers with Giancarlo Stanton, Aaron Judge, and the rest of that team would combine for 17 homers so far through heading into Wednesday's game, with only the Twins and the Royals having hit fewer? That Oakland would start the season 1-7. They actually started the season 0-6. That they would start 1-7 and then go on an 11-game winning streak? to share first place with the Seattle Mariners? I did not. I did not see any of those things coming. This is just your gentle reminder that April is always a weird month. And as we look more closely at the National League East, it is such a weird division. And I guess the question we have to ask ourselves about the National League East is, are these teams, where no team is more than a game over 500, and all of these teams are within a game and a half of each other right now, will this continue all season? Is this going to be a season where you have a bunch of teams that finish in the 80s in the wins total? Will 87 wins win this division? Will 85 wins win this division? And if that's the case, is that because all of these teams are so good that they're going to beat up on each other? Or is it just that this division is maybe a little bit more mediocre than we thought? Maybe it's not as good as we thought. I mean, there are all-stars littered, young stars littered throughout this division. And yet, it's kind of a witch's brew of mediocrity so far. At least, if you're watching the Phillies, they've been a pretty mediocre group. The Atlanta Braves have lost a bunch of games so far. The Mets have had a rough week. So this is an interesting division, and I think we'll see it play out a little bit more, but I am leaning more towards the National League East feeling a little bit more like the NFC East last year in the NFL. Like, we've got a lot of teams that maybe and this is kind of how I felt about the Braves and the Mets. I didn't think they were quite as good as the rest of the national media was making them out to be, and I thought the Phillies were a little bit closer to them in terms of their roster. Right now, all the rosters in these divisions, and I'm going to throw Miami into the mix. I mean, they're at 8-9, right? They have a better record than Atlanta, a little better record than Washington, but all these teams are essentially in the same place right now. Miami went to the playoffs last year, so I might as well put them in the middle here. They've got a good young player in Jazz Chisholm. They've got lots of other talented pitching. So why not put Miami with the rest of them? And the Nationals have recovered a little bit. They've played a little bit better these last couple of days. It's still super duper early. But I'm more leaning towards the National League East maybe being a little bit more on the side of mediocre as opposed to really, really good and just beating up on everybody. But we'll see as they play more games outside the division moving forward. If they start owning these other divisions, teams in the National League Central, teams in the National League West not named the Dodgers, and then own their interleague schedule, we'll get a better sense. But right now, the way I've seen the Phillies play and the way I've seen the Braves and the Mets play thus far, I have not been overly impressed with the Braves and the Mets. And I've seen a bunch of Nationals games too. I have not been impressed with the Nationals so far here in 2021. So we'll see how the National League East shakes out here as the season goes along. But so far, again, not a terribly impressive division, leaning more on the side of mediocrity than five really good teams just pounding each other into submission. All right, it's time for the Patreon mailbag, and we received five emails this time around, which is a little bit less than we normally get. So next time, if you haven't signed up on the Hit and Season Patreon, now's a great time to do that. And we'll do another one of these. We'll maybe do one of these a month. And these are usually very popular, and so we always answer Patreon member mailbag questions first here on the podcast, and then we'll do some mailbag episodes where we open it up to the rest of the Twitter family, which is probably many of you listening as well. But let's go to the Patreon mailbag, and Tom Comerford asks, "Hey, John, my wife and I just welcomed our first child into the world a few weeks ago. Tom, congratulations, buddy. Nothing better in the world than being a dad, man. Congratulations. I hope you guys are going to have a ton of fun." He says, "With my wife and her family being Mets fans, and with us living in Brooklyn, I was wondering if you have any advice on how to tip the scales towards my son becoming a Phillies fan. Aside from becoming a Mets fan, my biggest fear for my son is that in a divided baseball household, he'll split the difference and become a Yankees fan. Help! Keep up the great work with the podcasts." Thank you, Tom, very much. Man, I wish I had words of wisdom, Tom. I wish I had words of comfort. But you see, I'm in the exact same situation you are, my friend. I live in Northern Virginia, as most of you listening know. And as most of you listening know, and Tom, I hope you didn't ask this question, because you know that my oldest son is a diehard Nationals fan. And I tried to get him to come over to the Phillies. I did my very best. But see, what happened was I used to work a late shift, and I used to not get home until about 9 o'clock. And so my son used to go over to his grandfather's house, and my father-in-law is a huge Nationals fan, and they used to watch Nationals games. And that's fine because that's what was on. That's the hometown team. And my son just gravitated towards rooting for the hometown team and has become a big Nationals fan. And I try, and he likes to watch the Phillies. He'll watch any team, but he's not a Phillies fan. He is a Nationals fan through and through, a diehard Nats guy, and there's no changing it. So if it just, again, I think it's really going to depend how aggressive is your wife and her family going to be to try and make him Mets fans. My guess is he's probably going to become a Mets fan, Tom, because his friends will probably be Mets fans. If he's watching Mets games with your wife's family, he'll probably be a Mets fan. And you know what? At the end of the day, it's fine with me. It's fine with me that my son is a Nationals fan. It really is, because he's a baseball fan. And he's rooting for his hometown team. There's something to be said about rooting for the team that plays in the city you grew up in. I would love to hand down my Phillies fandom to the next generation. And I've got two other sons, and they might take up the mantle. My one son is not really that interested in sports. My other son, my littlest son, loves baseball, loves sports, but hasn't really picked a team yet. I think he's leaning Nationals too, because he idolizes his older brother. Nevertheless, I remain hopeful that maybe I could convince one of my children to be a Phillies fan. And my middle child actually prefers the Phillies. If he watches baseball, he roots for his dad's team. But kids are different. Kids are funny. Some kids like to pick a team so they can razz their dad in a fun way and kind of poke the bear a little bit. And some sons want to kind of do whatever's going to please their dad and root for the team their dad likes. And depending on, you know, if you have a son or a daughter, and it could be, and I just happen to have three sons, but daughters are, you know, girls are some of the best baseball fans in the world. We have tremendous women on this podcast as baseball experts and analysts. And Liz Rocher is one of the most knowledgeable baseball people in the world. So if you have daughters, you have sons, no matter what child you have, it's, I think, going to be mostly an influence from their friends and where they're living. So it may have nothing to do with you, Tom. He may or she may be a Mets fan. I do agree that I hope they don't split the difference and become a Yankees fan. That wouldn't be cool. And I get the feeling that at the very least you and your wife and her family would not let that happen. But my advice to you would be to embrace whatever team he wants to root for. Find the good in him rooting for the hometown team, and you guys can have a fun rivalry together. And that's kind of what I've been developing with my oldest son. A fun little rivalry developing together. It helps, you can make it fun. It doesn't have to be, you can have fun and enjoy baseball and enjoy your favorite team with your son as he enjoys, or daughters as they enjoy their favorite team. And enjoy baseball that way. All right, Tom Snow, one of our good buddies from the Patreon mailbag, says, I know this sounds rash, but can you see the Phillies making an early trade for a center fielder sometime in May or June? If so, who do you guys like out there? Well, there are a few names out there, and I don't know. I mean, I think Mickey Moniak has done enough here over the last couple of days to at least give himself a little more rope. So this is not something that's going to happen in the next couple of days. But if Moniak does struggle, I think that you could see Dave Dombrowski strike and go out and get a center fielder. Michael A. Taylor is a guy who I think would have made a lot of sense for the Phillies late in the offseason if the Kansas City Royals hadn't jumped on him. He signed a one-year, $1.75 million contract with them. He signed in November. I'm sorry, for some reason I thought he signed late in the offseason, but no, it was in November when they got him, at the end of November. You know, he was a guy who was a hero during the 2019 postseason run, but never really hit the way the Nationals were expecting him to. He is a career .239 hitter and has a career on-base percentage under .300. But he's always been able to play really good defense. He's always been a pretty good runner, and he does kind of give you some clutchosity every once in a while. Now, right now, Kansas City is off to a pretty good start, so they're not looking to trade anybody right now, and he's a cheap option, and he's a cheap player for them, so I wouldn't expect him to be on the trade market anytime soon, but I don't expect Seattle to stay in the mix in the American League West, and if they kind of fall out of the race, you could see him on the trade block. I know Scott Lauber mentioned a guy named Mark Cana. Oakland, when he wrote this piece, was off to a rough start, but obviously they've won 11 in a row, so they're probably not trading anybody right now. I think a guy like, if Milwaukee doesn't do a whole lot this year, maybe they make Lorenzo Cain available. Kevin Kiermaier is a guy that everybody talks about, but both of those guys make a lot of money. Cain is owed $18 million in 2022, and Kiermaier is under contract for a cheaper number, $12 million in 2022. But I don't really anticipate the Tampa Bay Rays letting him go at this point. There's some other guys who are not really center fielders, but you might be able to stick out there. Mitch Haniger of the Mariners, again, another Seattle player. If they fall out of contention in the American League West, maybe Mitch Haniger's a guy who becomes available, and he's a decent player. He's gotten off to a really hot start, but he's missed a lot of time with injury over the last couple of years. Missed most of 2019 and 2020. He ruptured a testicle, felling a pitch off his groin back in June of 2019. So, I mean, he's only 30, but he's missed a lot of time, but was a former All-Star during the 2018 season, and he's pretty cheap. A couple of guys out there that have been mentioned, Randall Grichuk of the Blue Jays. They've got a lot of outfielders there. That they could be looking, if they need to make a midseason trade, they could look to move him to fill an area of need. So maybe if the Phillies have something of surplus, that could work out, but that doesn't really seem like a great fit. And I know Corey Seidman mentioned Anthony Santander of the Orioles. The Orioles are not going to compete, so I would imagine anybody on Baltimore would be available. He's got some power. Santander's got some power, but he's more of a corner outfielder than he is a center fielder at this point in his career, so I don't know that he would be somebody that the Phillies would be looking to plug out in center field. And then, Seidman also mentions guys like A.J. Pollock and Jason Hayward. Both are expensive, but both might be made available at some point during this offseason. So those are some potential center field options. Obviously, the best option would be for Mickey Moniak to hit. I don't think anybody wants Odubel Herrera to come up and play center field. So maybe in May or June, we will certainly have a better idea how good Moniak is and how well he's doing. A lot of those options that I just mentioned, none of them seem like really terrific fits, except for maybe Michael A. Taylor is probably, I would love a little more offense from center field, but if you're just looking for somebody to kind of stabilize things in the eight hole, Michael A. Taylor also won't cost the Phillies all that much and probably won't put them over the luxury tax, which is, again, something you have to consider when you're thinking about all these different players. And by the way, Joe Vincent also asked the same question as Tom Snow. So, Joe, I'm not ignoring your question, but center field questions, trade options were popular here, apparently, on the Hit and Season Patreon. Brian Bingaman asks, hey, John, do you have faith in the bats to get back to going strong? Also, do you think it's about time to put Gene in the leadoff spot? Talking about Gene Segura. Yeah, I probably would have put Gene Segura in the leadoff spot if he hadn't hit the injury list. And I think Brian sent this to me before he had been placed on the injury list. Obviously, Andrew McCutchen is a big problem at the top of the lineup. Just as big a problem as what's been going on in center field is what Andrew McCutchen has been doing in left field. He is not a great defender, and he has not been hitting. He's been pounding one ball after another into the ground all season long so far. McCutchen not able to elevate anything right now and just has been an easy out at the top. I mean, it's been an automatic out at the top of the lineup right now. So I do believe the bats will get going. I do believe that they will, that center field can continue to be as bad as it has been. They're not going to hit under 100 all season long, even if it's Moniak, right? So they've got, center field has to get better. I'm just not convinced Andrew McCutchen is going to get better. And so that might be an area where they really have to figure something out with the trade deadline. Making a move, finding somebody to hit at the top of the lineup. Here's the problem. It's hard to find a good leadoff hitter. The Phillies have been looking for a good leadoff hitter forever. So I don't know how you fix that. Andrew McCutchen just has to play a little bit better, has to hit better. That's probably the thing I'm least convinced of, because I do think the rest of the offense will come around. I think Alec Bohm will come around. I'm convinced Gene Segura will hit. I'm convinced the rest of the lineup will hit. I think Rhys Hoskins will continue to play pretty well. But they've got to figure something out with that 8-9-1 spot in the order. And right now, they're not getting anything out of that. I do think this team will hit better. I think they'll hit better with runners in scoring position. And I do think some of the trends that we've seen early on here will reverse themselves. One of them being ground ball rate and fly ball rate. For a number of players, their ground ball rate has skyrocketed this year compared to their fly ball rate. The Phillies are just hitting a ton of grounders this year. They're hitting a ton of balls on the ground. And we don't want everybody to go launch angle crazy again, right? But you can't hit everything into the ground. There's got to be a happy medium somewhere. Bryce Harper has found that happy medium. The rest of the offense hasn't been able to find it. And I think it's just a matter of time. The bats are a little bit behind right now. I do think they will get going, especially as the months get warmer. But they've got to do a better job hitting with runners in scoring position, playing situational baseball. It'd be nice if this team could use a little bit of their speed and steal some bases, but that's just not the way baseball teams play anymore. And so you've got to get these guys hitting the ball in the air. And Alec Bohm, I think, really has to step up his game in the middle of the lineup. He had a monster home run on Tuesday night. An absolute blast to left field, and that was good to see. We need to see a little bit more of that from him, and it would be nice to see Rhys Hoskins also continue to be a little bit more consistent at the plate than he has been. But I do think the offense will get going just a little bit. And yeah, I would consider putting Gene Segura in the leadoff spot. It's not ideal. He doesn't give you a great on-base percentage, but he does hit a lot. When he's at his best, he's a 300 hitter, and he's done that throughout his career, except the 2 years he's been in Philadelphia. So I think it's worth a shot. I think they have to try something different, and something different doesn't necessarily mean Matt Joyce playing left field and batting leadoff. It just, that doesn't inspire a whole lot of confidence. Finally, Justin sends a message. He says, "Hey, John, thanks for the great article today about the weirdness of April. A good reminder to chill out about the 9-9 start. My question, we saw an encouraging opposite field home run from Moniak against the Giants. If his bat actually develops enough to earn him a spot in the lineup every day long term, which outfield position do you see him sticking in? Say 2 to 3 years down the road, what's your sense of his floor and ceiling defensively?" Well, I think we've seen that he can play a pretty good defensive center field. He's made a couple of spectacular plays out there. We'll see over the long term if he's able to make all of the plays, all of the routine plays. And some of the 4- and 5-star plays, according to StatCast. I think his bat does not play up well enough to be a corner guy. So I think if he's going to be a major leaguer, he's either going to be a number 4 outfielder who can fill in at any one of those 3 spots. But if he's going to be an everyday player, it has to be in center field. Because I don't see him being a 25 to 30 home run a year guy. I don't see him being a super high on-base percentage, steal a ton of bases guy that you could play in left field or right field and have as your leadoff guy. So I think he's 2 to 3 years down the road. If he's an everyday major leaguer, it's as a center fielder. Because you can get more offensive production from your left fielder and your right fielder. But what you need from center field is you need an above average defense guy. And I think what we've seen from Moniak this year, since he got called up, is that he can make some of the spectacular plays. But it remains to be seen over a longer stretch how well he's going to do out there. So it's still really early to tell, right? Too early to tell exactly where he's going to end up long-term, and even if he will be here long-term. I think everybody's mildly encouraged at his last couple games. Getting that first hit on Tuesday helped relax him a little bit. Hitting the 3-run home run, you could just see the relief on his face to get that first one out of the way. He's a bigger kid than anybody, I think, thought when we envisioned him in the minor leagues. He looks like a kid who can put the bat on the ball and hit it with some authority. If he can just get an approach at the plate that's going to work. And that's the big key. He's got to not be overmatched at the plate, which is what he was through his first few games, now maybe starting to settle in. And I think if he is going to be an everyday major leaguer, it's going to be as a center fielder. All right, that wraps up our Patreon mailbag for this week. And again, we'll do another one of these next month in the month of May. And we'll also do some Twitter questions in the next mailbag as well. So you folks on Twitter can get some stuff in. But again, I'm not always able to get in all of the Twitter questions. I will make it a point to get in all of the Patreon mailbag questions. So if you want to become a Patreon member of Hit and Season, again, go to patreon.com/hitandseason and sign up on one of the tiers, and you can be eligible to get in on, get guaranteed, get your mailbag questions answered. And if you want your mailbag questions answered by me, still not sure why anybody thinks I'm an expert on any of this stuff, but I'm happy to serve. All right, time for your stat of the week, everybody. I don't know if any of you caught the end of the A's-Twins game on Wednesday, but it was pretty nuts. I just caught the ninth inning. The A's were trailing 10-9 in the ninth, and the A's tied the score to send it into extra innings. The Twins then scored two in the top of the 10th, only to watch the A's score three in the bottom of the 10th inning, thanks to a throwing error by the third baseman on a routine grounder with the bases loaded that allowed the tying and the winning runs to score. A brutal loss for the Minnesota Twins, and the A's were handed their 11th straight victory. That's right, the A's have won 11 in a row, and that's after starting the season 0-6. According to Elias Sports, Oakland is the first team in Major League Baseball history to win 11 straight games at any point in the season. After starting 0-6, the A's managed to do both within their first 19 games of the season. Again, April is a kooky month. All right, folks, that's going to do it for this edition of Hittin' Season. Thank you so much for tuning in, and please don't forget to check out thegoodfight.com each and every day. We've got lots of good writers doing lots of good work over there. Check out all of the Good Fight podcast shows that we have for you, Continued Success, The Dirty Inning. And also, don't forget to, again, go to the Patreon, sign on up. You can get Absolutely Hammered, the podcast exclusive podcast with Chris Jones and Justin Clue. I've got some baseball cards to open. We're going to do that in the coming days and do a video series there with that. We've got lots of other cool stuff there as well, so make sure you check it all out as soon as you can and tell a friend about the Good Fight podcast feed. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in. We'll talk to you next time here on Hittin' Season.